Welcome back to Dave's Gone By. You know, maybe one day, if a miracle happens, if something unbelievably incredible happens, or if, let's say, half of the stars in Hollywood were somehow killed, I might wind up hosting The Tonight Show. It would be a dream, I admit. It would be one of those things that every entertainer on some level probably has fantasized about, all of us Rupert Pupkins thinking, we could do that. We could sit on the couch and talk to that person, talk to that star, be entertaining, be effortlessly witty, and make for good television. Well, how did that all start? All those years ago, before Conan, before Jimmy Kimmel, before Leno, even before Carson, and before Jack Parr, the person who really, really got it all going for that late-night kind of entertainment was a fellow named Steve Allen. Now, certainly not an obscure person by any means in entertainment, and yet also, I think, perhaps a little underrated, a little underappreciated, and especially since his death, not quite getting his due for just how he changed and reshaped late-night television and certainly the talk show format. Now, someone who I'm sure agrees with me, or whom I'm sure agrees with me, see, that's the kind of correction Steve Allen would make, is Ben Alba. And Ben is the author of Inventing Late Night, Steve Allen and the Original Tonight Show. Alba is a law professor at DePaul University, but obviously is interested in the subject and dug into just how the whole Tonight Show thing came about through the genius of Steve Allen. So, Ben, welcome to the Daverhood.
Well, thank you, Dave. It's great to be on your show.
Thank you. Thanks. And make believe that I'm at this desk here and you're sitting by me on
the chair. I'm on the couch right now.
You're on the couch. Okay, good. You can even take your shoes off. In my version of The Tonight Show, I want people to be really comfortable.
I'll have another cup of coffee if you have some there.
You've got it. With a shot of liqueur in there, in fact.
Maybe that might come in due time.
Hey, now. Well, Ben, the origin of The Tonight Show. Tell.
Well, it really revolves around a series of experiments that Steve Allen had conducted in early radio and in early television. And it really wasn't the kind of show where he sat down and decided, well, I think I'm going to put the desk here and have a couch, and I think I'm going to interview people in the audience. These were all things that sort of evolved.
Mm-hmm.
And when he was in radio, and maybe if we just kind of jump back to the mid-1940s, the format of radio at the time was very tightly scripted, and Steve introduced an element of spontaneity into radio that had not really been that well developed at the time. And this was, as he would be willing to admit, out of sheer laziness, because he was hired by a radio station in L.A., KNX, in fact, the CBS affiliate there, to basically spin records and make short announcements in between songs. And everything else that he did was very, very tightly written. So that, for example, if you had, let's say, Rochester asking, or Jack Benny asking Rochester, hey, Rochester, where's my comb? And Rochester might fire back, well, Mr. Benny, it's in your top drawer, right next to your hair. And, you know, that would be funny,
yeah.
But it was scripted, you know, and Steve Allen found a way to kind of take the lazy way out of having to write everything he said by deciding to interview celebrities. And so rather than writing out scripts for himself to read on the air, he would be outlining interviews for celebrities, and he found he could do that with a lot less work, and it would still do quite well in front of an audience. And that was working pretty well until one day when Doris Day, who was the scheduled guest, for some reason, I think it was a booking mistake by her agent, but she just didn't show up.
Mm-hmm.
And Steve had 20 minutes of air to fill, and he didn't really know what to do because he had an audience there in the studio watching him, and he had already played both sides of Doris Day's new record. So with 20 minutes of air to fill, he thought maybe, and this just kind of came to him, you know, maybe what if I take the floor mic here, which at that time was no small piece of equipment, you know, this clunky thing with the iron stand, and he dragged it into the audience, and he thought, you know, I think I'm going to go interview all of you nice people out here. And that's when he discovered that a nice little exchange between him and somebody in the audience would generate a far bigger laugh than the best scripted line with Bob Hope. So, I mean, who would have thought that this was just an epiphany to him, and that was one of the elements that he took from radio into television became an element and a staple on The Tonight Show.
Well, what is the time frame that we're talking about? Because obviously we all think of Groucho Marx doing You Bet Your Life.
Right.
And certainly discovering the reason people watched that was not so much the contest part of it or the duck coming down, but the way he would goof around with the contestants.
Right.
So was Marx after, before, middle?
Actually, Marx was a big fan of Steve Allen. And the Steve Allen show that I'm referring to ran about in the late 1940s, around 1948 to 1950.
Oh, that early?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So, Marx wasn't until, what, the late 50s, right?
Maybe early to mid and late 50s, yeah. Throughout the 1950s, he was on there.
But Marx
was a great admirer of Steve Allen. In fact, Bob Hope, there's a story that Bob Hope was in a car with one of his, I forgot the name of one of his dear friends, but they were driving around Hollywood, and Bob looked at his watch and said, wait a minute, if it's 11 o'clock, I think we better get to a radio so we can listen to this young kid, Steve Allen, because he was a big admirer of his.
I mean, Allen was really an innovator.
I'd say that his most unique talent, aside from just being incurably curious about things, which I think is a huge asset, he was also bright, witty, and very spontaneous. And I think the spontaneity is really the key to Steve Allen. He had that ability to react very quickly. And in fact, if anything, he would pray for things to go wrong on the air, because that's what gave him a springboard for his creativity. He would almost be bored if everything went the way it was written in the script, because there'd be no surprises.
Well, what are some of the real actual examples of times when things went a little haywire and he was there to, pick up the pieces like magic?
Well, here's one example. He was supposed to be doing this nightly demonstration, commercial on-the-air demonstration of the miracle material at the time called fiberglass. I'm sure you remember that. And there was a fiberglass chair, and he was supposed to take a sledgehammer and bang it against the chair and prove in front of millions of people on the air how indestructible that chair was. And that was working for a few nights, but then one night he took the hammer to the chair, and for some inexplicable reason, the chair just shattered into hundreds of pieces. And without even missing a beat, Steve Allen looked at the audience and said, well, ladies and gentlemen, just as you guessed, this sledgehammer is made of fiberglass. You know how quick that guy was.
Yeah, that's
and he could recover. Because at that, in those early days, there was no tape delay. I mean, you couldn't just stop tape and edit and then fix the mistake. It was live, and every moment counted. And you had to recover and figure out what to do if things were not going the way they were planned. And it was really funny, because I was one of the people, there were about 35 people that I interviewed for this book, who were both in front of and behind the cameras. But the first producer of The Tonight Show, Bill Harbach, was commenting to me about that era, and I just kind of made this offhand remark about, well, yeah, you had no tape delay back then. And he said, no tape delay? There was no tape. And, I mean, just imagine what that was. It was really an adventure going back into that early era of television.
Wow. And any other examples of times that he really just went caught something and turned disaster into magic?
I don't know if it's so much turning disaster into magic as much as his ability to know how to react to a guest. And he had a lot of fun with just everyday folks in the audience. And oftentimes, the decision that he would make, and he had to make it right on the spot, had to be the right one to bring out the humor that he found. And one night he was taking the show on the road to Miami Beach, and the Tonight Show under his leadership was one of the first shows ever to go on the road. And so he was interviewing different people in the audience, and one of the guests that he had on the show was the great golfer Sam Snead. And maybe a few minutes later into the show, he was out in the audience and he found Sam's wife just sitting there, and he had her stand up and he introduced her and he said, ladies and gentlemen, here we have the wife of the great golfer, here's Mrs. Sam Snead. And audience applauds politely. And then Steve starts interviewing her, has a nice little exchange with her, and then in the course of the discussion, he asks her, well, do you have any superstitions that you follow that help your husband perform better in his golf game. And she said, well, you know, every night before he goes to bed, I kiss his balls.
Oh, no.
And Steve made the right decision. What he did was he just did a deadpan take into the camera and did not change the expression on his face.
Right.
The audience started dying. And about a good minute and a half into the laughter, and he was still deadpan, Mrs. Sneed catches herself and she goes, oh, I mean his golf balls. And it made it even worse.
Yeah, of course.
And this is a story that was told to me by Steve Lawrence, who was one of the regular singers on the show during that time.
Oh, that's
But I mean, isn't that, I mean, just to be able to recover like that, or to make the most out of the situation like that, where you know there's nothing you need to add to that, and that laughter just went on for a good 2 minutes.
Well, you know, Carson learned from that. I mean, that's where he learned, I'm assuming. I mean, he had his own great skill, of course, but the idea of if he tells a lousy joke, the best thing to do is just sort of stay there, not move a facial muscle or anything, and let the joke die.
I interviewed Bob Costas, who had himself interviewed Steve Allen, and Bob had really admired just that ability of that look in terms of, you know, don't you wonder what I'm thinking right now, or I don't think there's anything I could add to that.
Well, we have a lot more to add about Steve Allen, because we're talking to Ben Alba, author of Inventing Late Night, and we'll do that right after this.
Hi, I'm Ben Alba, author of Inventing Late Night, Steve Allen, and the original Tonight Show, and you're listening to Dave's Gone By on WGBB and DFSX Radio.
Welcome back to Dave's Gone By, and no, it's not the Tonight Show, but we're asking a whole bunch of stuff about the origins and invention of the Tonight Show, and a man who really made that happen, Steve Allen, way back when, with a man who is now an expert on all of it, because he's written the book Inventing Late Night, Steve Allen, and the original Tonight Show, Ben Alba, and so far it's just been these wonderful stories of how Steve would take situations where things would go wrong and think of these wonderful quips or second guess what the FCC might be thinking. Oh, I don't know if there was an FCC back then, but...
Well, there was actually quite a bit of censorship at the time, and not so much that the censors would be coming in as much as the writers would be censoring themselves.
Mm.
Because, I mean, you couldn't even say the word pregnant on television.
And Lucy,
you might recall
Ricky
from the old I Love Lucy shows, Lucy was expecting. She wasn't pregnant. And so a lot of these, the writers, there was a certain amount of caution that they had to take. But sometimes I was talking with one of the writers named Bill Dana, who later became a character, comic actor in his own right with the Jose Jimenez character that he crafted.
And well, on the Steve Allen show.
That's right.
Yeah.
And Bill had told me that he started actually as a writer on the show. He wasn't originally a character actor, but he was a writer. And he remembered how sometimes the program practices people, that was the euphemism for the censors, might frown on something. And they were supposed to have Mae West on as a guest one time. And typically they would have these kinds of entertainers engage in comedy sketches. So they were trying to write a sketch for Mae West and Steve Allen where Mae was going to be the belle of the Yukon. And Mae had specifically requested the writers, and they were happy to oblige, to just write her very short lines and make each line that she says the punchline.
Mm.
And so they wrote a line in exchange for her and Steve to go something like, Steve introduces her and says, well, here we have the belle of the Yukon. Hi there, belle. And then May's response to that would be, ding dong. And the censors didn't like that. And they said, no, it's too suggestive.
Oh,
and
probably.
So they couldn't write that. And for whatever reason, they ended up not having her on the show at all. But just to show how strict they were back then.
And remember, this is a woman who was on Broadway 2 decades earlier in a show called Sex.
Yes.
Yeah. And yet how it's amazing how cyclical these things are with standards and practices in the FCC, where what might be okay but controversial one generation earlier is suddenly totally off limits in another medium two generations later. It's just, you know, mind-boggling the way all that goes.
Well, it's even amazing with when you look at characters or comedy that would have been acceptable in Steve Allen's time, like the lovable drunk that you saw on the Andy Griffith Show, Otis Campbell. You'd never have anybody like that portrayed today in that matter. I mean, I talked and interviewed with one of the current vice presidents at NBC, Rick Ludwin, and he was telling me that if you had a character like Otis on a program today, they'd have to show that he was going into rehab or going into a clinic. And even when he was overseeing the production of the 1980s era comedy, Cheers, you'll notice that you don't really have that many drunks there in the bar, even though a lot of these people have been drinking, but they don't portray people as being drunk.
Yeah, they always,
whereas it would have been much more acceptable in the heyday of Steve Allen to have characters like that.
Yeah, it's actually, we had to turn to the cartoons. That's what saved everything in the 1990s. It was, you know, The Simpsons was allowed to have Barney Gumble or Family Guy is now as characters who do a lot worse things than drink. So, I mean, thank God for them.
Mm-hmm.
We're also talking about the Bill Dana and Louis Nye had characters. Steve Allen, the whole character thing, I don't know if he quite invented all of that. I mean, that came from radio, too. But that's something that still continues to this day with Letterman, the guy under the stairs, or the crazy person who does this, or Leno will have his character-type people go out there and do things.
Yeah, the eccentric guests are the kind of weird people that are really not professional guests. They're not actors or comedians. And the early Tonight Show, Steve Allen had a knack for being able to discover these people and bring them aboard, and they would be extremely entertaining. I mean, you know, we had a lady that was featured in one of the Miami Beach shows. Her name, she just went by the name Mrs. Diehl, D-I-E-H-L. And she had a whole bunch of laughing parrots that came with her. And I think part of the charm of these parrots, if you want to call it that, was that they would just laugh nonstop until it was just downright irritating. And they closed the show one night with those parrots laughing, and they just never stopped. So, I mean, she's one example. Then there was a guy named Mr. Drapo who came on the show, and he taught Steve how to make a dress in 30 seconds.
Whoa.
And so you could see the guy, Mr. Drapo, taking this model who was clad in a slip. But, you know, while Skitch Henderson and the band were playing, I don't know, something like Flight of the Bumblebee or something in the background, he would be able to actually make this dress for the model in 30 seconds flat. And it actually had some kind of a fashion flair to it. But when Steve tried his hand at it, it was just a disaster. It was just a morass of fabric and rolls and all kinds of things, but
that just made it funny.
That made it funny. And then we had a guy named Joe Interlegi, who was known as the human termite, and he could basically bite and eat into wood. And one of his other tricks was that he, or not really tricks, but stunts was that he could pull a truck on the outside of the Hudson Theater there on 44th Street in New York. He could pull that truck using his ears and some cable.
That's like
and
the Mike
you,
Adam,
you had
yeah.
Steve Allen there right in front of him with the cameras there looking right down on him there at the curb. And he could literally do that. He'd be walking backwards on his hands and feet and pulling a, I think it was like a mail truck, something like that there. But it was just amazing. I mean, just very, very strange feats that people could pull. And I think, you know, long before you had these eccentric guests appearing on Johnny Carson and Leno, you know, the oldest this or the longest that, or however that.
Well, I have the longest.
Steve Allen did a lot of that.
Yeah. Well, that also goes back to what I said at the beginning of the interview, was that Letterman had enshrined Johnny Carson and said all these wonderful things, obviously when he was still alive and then as part of the eulogy thing. And whereas when Steve Allen passed, it was kind of a little more low-key with everybody, but he has as much or more of a debt to Steve Allen than he ever did to Johnny.
I'll tell you, though, that Letterman actually did pay great credit and great homage to Steve Allen.
Oh, good.
He had Steve Allen, I think, on one of the very first daytime shows that Dave had back in around 1980. And he even told Steve, you know, the desk, you basically brought the desk to television. We wouldn't be here unless you had come before us. So he really honored Steve. And, in fact, he made no small bones about the fact that at the time he had been given a daytime show, he ran over to the Museum of Television and Radio in Manhattan and looked up a lot of the old Steve Allen broadcasts from the early 60s when Steve had a syndicated show, nightly show, that Dave used to watch while he was in high school. And his director, Hal Gurney, who also directed for Jack Parr, had encouraged him to go to that museum and just kind of see what kind of inspiration he could get. And so when you see Dave doing things like the Alka-Seltzer Man, for example,
right?
Now, that really was inspired by Steve Allen doing the human tea bag, where Steve was emblazoned with about 200 tea bags, and they then dropped them into a clear vat of warm water, and he kind of waddled around there for a while, and then when he came back up to the surface, he proudly announced, "Tea is served."
That's funny now. It's just such a wonderfully absurdist idea.
It was,
I mean, I don't know if he wrote that idea, but to do it and to, you know.
It was always young humor, and I think that was another key to Steve Allen, was that it never got old or stodgy, and it was just because he had this youthful sense about him, and he was a hit in his early career among college students. I found, and I quote in the book, a review when Steve was still in his 20s about how the students at University of Southern Cal loved what he was doing on television. And then, would you believe that the night before Steve passed away in October of 2000, he was performing before a standing room only crowd at Valley View Community College in Southern California. So, I mean, he had young kids admiring him for many, many years throughout his career.
Yeah, although something did happen towards the end there, and I never quite understood why, of all people, he would be involved in all that. But the last thing, and I think this also worked against him, that we remember about Steve Allen was towards the later years his campaign to clean up television.
Right.
And I was like, what the hell's wrong with you? I mean, you were out there live on late night. The whole point was pushing the envelope and trying to give a wink or a deadpan and let the audience know that something dirty was going on without giving away the game. Well, you have to ratchet that up 50 years later because we're more and or less sophisticated now. But how, of all people, can you be the one out there saying, don't use this language, don't talk about sex, there's too much violence? Do you get where that all came from? Where did
it
shift?
He was trying to make a point that I think might have been, maybe it was lost in the way it was presented or the way it got portrayed in the media, but his main concern was the introduction of vulgarity for its own sake, without making a point, and making it part of the mainstream so that children were exposed to it. This is the same man that admired people like Lenny Bruce,
yes,
and would put them on the air, even in an age when a lot of other broadcasters wouldn't want to take a chance on him. But what Steve Allen admired was the fact that Lenny Bruce, despite his vulgarity, was making social commentary, that he was a social philosopher. And what seemed to rile Steve up was humor that went for vulgarity strictly as the punchline or for a cheap laugh rather than to make a more intelligent point. And that when it was in the mainstream and in front of children like that, he was most concerned about how that would be absorbed into maybe the coarseness of society. So that, I think, when you try to explain that to maybe a more mainstream audience, it wasn't as clearly defined, but Steve wasn't the only one. I mean, even Jonathan Winters, when I interviewed him, expressed that same concern, and Jonathan said he has never ever had to perform blue, and in fact, when he would be booked at various nightclubs, and he might be asked by the owner about, are you going to make jokes about the chicks in the first row of the audience, or about how you want to go out with them after the show and things like that, and he said, well, I don't know if you really want to have me here. I've always been a hit with audiences, young and old, and I've never had to resort to that. So it was something that Steve felt strongly about, and he always was not afraid to take a risk on a political topic throughout his career. I mean, he was championing civil rights when he was younger, and he was against the death penalty and nuclear war. He had programs against organized crime where he would conduct serious discussions about that and McCarthyism. So that this is one of many stands that he had taken, but maybe because it was so late in his life yes, unfortunately, he might have been characterized as maybe an angry old man when so much of the rest of him was just a very young, humor-filled, energy-filled entertainer.
Actually, you mentioned McCarthy, so I want to go there, especially since there's been so much renewed interest in that era thanks to Good Night and Good Luck.
Yes, that's right.
He would have been on TV from the 50s to the end, I mean, during that whole time. So at what point did he take a stand, and what stand did he take?
Well, the he had shows in, let's see, I'm just trying to recall, probably around maybe 1954 or 55, where he would bring in a panel to discuss McCarthyism, which was something that was just not discussed on a show like that before. The stand that he took was that it really shouldn't matter what the political leanings of a guest would be, and so he would have people on that were blacklisted. In fact, the network had urged him not to put people on there, and he had Jack Gilford and Jack was blacklisted. He had one other comedian on, Abe Burrows, I think.
Another guy
that they didn't want to have him on. And in fact, Lena Horne was blacklisted because of her support of civil rights, and she had gone through sort of a down period in the early 1950s, and then in fact had to go travel to Europe and perform there in order to keep her career going at the time. And he had no problem having her on the show, and in fact he remained very, very good friends with her throughout the rest of his life.
And he was successful enough or respected enough by the network that he could get away with telling them, I want these people on my show?
It appeared that he was, because I interviewed one of his principal writers, Herb Sargent, went on to become the supervising writer for Saturday Night Live. And Herb said, of all the experiences that he ever had throughout his career, the one that he really got the most satisfaction out of, he said, including SNL, was working with Steve Allen, because he got such a charge out of a guy that acted on principle. And he remembered, and he literally quoted in the book about this exchange that Steve had with some of the network brass. You know, when they told him, no, don't put these people on there, and Steve would go, well, goodbye, I'm having them on. And Herb said, I just got such a great charge out of that.
Rightfully so. Ah, fine wine, great books, priceless antiques. All that's missing is something to listen to. But of course, episodes of Dave's Gone By, the music, the comedy, the perceptive talk, entire shows preserved on compact disc, any episode you choose. Just $12, shipping included. No home is complete without Dave's Gone By on CD, so visit davesgoneby.org because you're worth it. I love internet radio. You can surf stations and music for free and listen anytime on your computer. And I love Live365.com for playing vintage episodes of Dave's Gone By Thursday nights at 8 and 11. And I love the comedy channel that they're on, DFSX Radio. But those letters, DFSX, who can remember that? Good thing you don't have to. Just go to davesgoneby.org and click their link to hear my shows. Spread the radio love.
Hi, I'm Ben Alba, author of Inventing Late Night, Steve Allen and the Original Tonight Show, and you're listening to Dave's Gone By on WGBB and DFSX Radio.
Did you ever know Steve personally, or is it all just from research?
I think a lot of it from research, a lot of it from the interviews. In many ways, I feel like having gone through this that I've sort of lived through the era, but I did have a meeting with Steve in 1997, which really wasn't even connected with the book. I didn't even have a book in mind. It was just that I had admired one of the people that was a regular on the Original Tonight Show, Andy Williams. I'd grown up listening to his records and watching his television show, and I had a chance to meet with Andy about 12 years ago, which led to opportunities for me to do some freelance writing for him on his CDs and videos. And as a result, I ended up as I got more curious about Andy's early career as a regular on The Tonight Show, I was able to contact Steve Allen and find out more about what Andy's early career was like. And when I met with Steve in his office in Van Nuys, California, two things really surprised me about that meeting. One was I didn't know the extent to which Steve was involved in literally inventing late-night television. I mean, he really invented an original American art form. Because you know, when you take for granted the desk and the monologue and kidding around with the band leader and the celebrity interviews and going to the audience and having these exotic animals and eccentric guests and stunts and all these things, I mean, they all began with that one man, Steve. And he was so proud of these early shows that he did, and yet he was also very saddened by the fact that hardly any video evidence of those shows exists. So that got me thinking, and a couple of weeks later, I asked him if it might be possible if we could collect all the memories of the people that were involved in these early shows and put them in a book for him. And that's when he told me that if I wanted to take on this project myself, he would be happy to refer me to all of his friends and colleagues. And I thought, well, how do you turn something like that down? So, that's when I embarked on the 35 interviews and getting more and more in touch with people that knew Steve. And then he would send me audio clips or video clips of some of the rare programs that still exist in his archives, as well as newspaper clippings and reviews and other materials. So slowly but surely, the book began to take shape. But unfortunately, Steve passed away very suddenly in October of 2000. But then I approached his family about a year or two later.
Was Jane Meadows helpful?
Jane Meadows was extremely helpful.
Right.
And in fact, she had appeared on a number of book signings with me in the Los Angeles area about 3 or 4 months ago.
Oh, that's lovely.
And just a wonderful, I mean, I think this is almost therapeutic for her, where she gets to kind of relive the days with her husband. And I think you can tell it was just a wonderful marriage that they had for 46 years. And it really gives me a very warm feeling, and it makes me feel both humbled and gratified to know that she really loves the book and she has been very supportive of it.
Is it the first book you've written?
It is.
Is there another in the pipeline?
Well, at the moment, I'm not too sure. I'm thinking possibly of trying to focus on some of the great musical comedy variety shows in the 1960s, which I think is a lost American art form. We don't really have those anymore.
You're talking about like the Liza with a Z and My Name is Barbara kind of things?
Or Dean Martin show, or
right.
Andy Williams when he had his show, or Perry Como, things like that, and going into the Sonny and Cher era.
Those do, I mean, maybe thanks to all the nostalgia channels, and I know that I keep seeing the infomercial for the Dean Martin DVD.
That's right.
So there's got to be a something of a resurgence for these shows, even though they were kind of slick and kind of dumb. There was also a great amount of talent and just, I don't know if I call them quite an art form, but certainly of an entertainment form.
Well,
that was valuable.
I would say, my theory would be that they were actually in many ways quite original, in the sense that a lot of the numbers that were written for the show, particularly where it was a musical host, where they would have to interact with the guests, they would be written just for that 1 week, and then you'd have to move on to something else. But I always remember a production number that Andy Williams did. It was with Elton John, who made his first American television network debut on Andy's show in 1971. And Ray Charles, Elton and Ray were playing the piano, and Cass Elliot. And they were all singing together, and it was a great number. And you just don't have that kind of television anymore, where you have all that kind of interaction between the host and the guests. Usually now the guests do their own thing, and then that's it.
Well, what song were they all singing together?
They were singing a song, I think this was a hit back at the time, called Heaven Help Us All.
Really place it.
And I think, I'm trying to remember if it was Ray Charles that wrote it, or one of your listeners I'm sure would know, but it was a pretty big hit back at the time, and they were doing that. It was a great number.
I guess to close this interview with Ben Alba about Steve Allen, and I mean, we're going back to Steve Allen, there you interview, as you mentioned, a bunch of people in the book, like Jane Meadows and Bill Dana and Herb Sargent, and some of the great comedians.
In fact, some of them we've already lost since the interviews. I did an interview a number of years ago with Louie Nye, who passed away recently. Skitch Henderson, I think most recently, died in November of 2005.
Right.
And Bobby Short, I may possibly have gotten one of the last interviews with Bobby just about a year ago, in February of 2005, and he passed away in March.
What was his connection to...
Well, he was a guest a couple of times on the show, and he had some very insightful and, I think, poignant observations of what it was like for artists of color to perform on television at that time when they weren't really that welcome on the air. And it was Steve Allen who was one of the very few people that gave them a national platform. And really, in Bobby's words, Steve was able to do this and not really make a big to-do about it. He just had you on because he believed you were talented. In fact, Steve had written an essay. He was invited to write an essay for Ebony magazine, and he titled it "Talent is Colorblind," which really reflected his views. But Bobby Short was somebody who passed away. The writers Herb Sargent and Stan Burns, and quite a number of other people that, unfortunately, it's a generation that's passing before us. But I'm just so glad to capture these recollections before they're too late.
Can we get like one more quote or two of some of these things that people have said about Steve, even if they're not particularly funny, even if they're more eulogical, if that's a word? I'm making it a word. It's a word. Which had that bell that Steve had. Schmock, schmock.
Well, eulogical, I'm sure he, it would go right up there with schmock, schmock that Steve Allen would have. But I think Larry Gelbart, the great writer who developed the television series MASH and was a longtime friend of Steve Allen, was fond of saying that Steve's mind was an office of creativity that was open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. He just thrived on that. And I think that really says quite a bit about the man. I think Steve was also very humble and a very down-to-earth guy that would just want to be remembered as a decent human being, although I think that he could be remembered for so much more.
I do hope that, most of all, aside from the fact that people go and get your book, which, by the way, how can they get that?
Well, it hopefully should be available at local bookstores all over and certainly on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
And it's called, again, Inventing Late Night, Steve Allen and the Original Tonight Show. So
with the foreword by Jay Leno. I forgot to
mention. Cool. Jay Leno doing the foreword.
It was very nice to do that.
It's Prometheus Books, right?
That's correct.
The publisher. So I obviously hope that people go out and buy this book, but also that we really appreciate and rediscover maybe at some anniversary point when the networks will cobble together some of the best ofs, or they'll get enough material to do a DVD set like they're doing of Dean Martin and really show the best of. Because I remember seeing Steve Allen show clips on public TV and seeing Louis Nye and Bill Dana and the other, and Pat Harrington and some of the other character actors.
Interviewed all of them. And fortunately, in terms of the Steve Allen Show, which was a primetime show that Steve did for NBC, a lot of those videos do exist. It's the early Tonight years that have almost been obliterated, unfortunately. And even if you had people like Eleanor Roosevelt or Richard Rogers or Jackie Robinson or Carl Sandburg on the show, the networks just didn't have the mentality at the time was that they would just either tape over stuff or not. Well, they didn't even have tape back then, but they just didn't. If they needed more shelf space for other things, they would just burn the kinescopes.
Well, I mean, the call just goes out to all the networks and to folks who might have archival material. Before you sell that house, before you close that warehouse, look around in the rafters in the attics. You never know. Maybe there's kinnies in there from God knows what, and hopefully we'll find more of that original Steve Allen and Tonight Show material. But at least we can live it mentally and imagine it through the pages of Inventing Late Night, thanks to Ben Alba. Ben, I want to thank you so much for sharing your Steve Allen thoughts and histories and memories on the neighborhood.
Well, it's been a blast, Dave. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks.